In her new book, Jennifer Ackerman asks all the questions we all have about owls. How do they fly so silently? Why do their eyes face forward? Are they, you know, wise? And then there's this question. Just how long have we humans been obsessed with owls? The answer to that one is forever, or seems like that. Ackerman says we evolved alongside them. We lived in the same woods and lands and caves. And she says we wove them into our stories and our art. Like in one of the earliest examples of cave art from 36,000 years ago.
In December of 1994, three cavers who were led by Jean-Marie Chauvet, who was a cave explorer, they noticed this air current, a kind of updraft. It was venting from some rocks in a limestone cliff, and they followed it, dug away some debris, they squeezed into this cave, and they went down, 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 deep into the cave, and found a clear representation of an owl. It was an etching, probably a Eurasian eagle owl or a long-eared owl. It has tufts. It's the first known representation of any bird in cave art. Chauvet feels that this bird wasn't depicted as, you know, as a kind of realistic vision of a bird, but was really evoked as a spirit. And we humans, we've been obsessed with owls for literally tens of thousands of years. All over the world, owls appear in stories and as symbols, sometimes of wisdom or beneficence, good fortune, and sometimes as emblems of evil and omens of death. And I think it's a combination of things that makes these birds so powerful for us. I think we see ourselves in them. You know, they have round heads and big forward-facing eyes, just like we do. You know, some species are kind of cute and human baby-like, but they're also so different from us. They're these creatures of the night. They're really fierce in their hunting. They're just mysterious and kind of uncanny. And so I think it's that whole package that makes these birds so exciting to our imaginations and sometimes so troubling.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Jennifer Ackerman is joining us to talk about her new book, What an Owl Knows. In it, she says, owls have a kind of duality. They seem cute, but they're also brutal. They're quirky, but also deadly serious. She says owls are seen as prophets or messengers. They're symbols of knowledge or a harbinger of death. So we have this deep history with them, but scientists are just now figuring out the real details of how they live their lives. Ackerman's own interest in owls began in the backyard.
We have a big old maple tree behind our house. It's probably 120 years old, massive tree. And one year I put up an owl box with the hopes that maybe it would draw something. Well, it took a few years, but one spring we had an eastern screech owl that took residence in that box, and it would roost during the daytime with just its little round head showing through the hole. And then at night, it would vanish. It would just disappear into the night, and I always tried to see it leave, but I never could. But in the morning, there would be signs of his expert hunting skill.
Yeah.
There would often be like a bird literally hanging out of the hole, and my daughters and I would sit at the kitchen table looking out on this box. It was just a few yards away from us. And it was really their first lesson in a top-of-the-line predator. We'd see this dead bird hanging out of the box, and then it would sort of twitch, twitch, twitch. And then it was pulled into the box. Once it was a wing of a blue jay, and another time it was a whole mourning dove. So it really intrigued me. It just made me so curious about these birds, how silent they are, how they come and go, how they're such expert hunters, and just really unique in the bird world.
You've talked about how, I don't know if it was from that moment or if you've often wondered, but you said your head sometimes would spin with these collection of questions about owls, like how they, all kinds of questions, I guess.
Yes. You know, when I thought about writing this book, it really did make my head kind of just whirl with questions. You know, I wanted to learn what makes an owl an owl, and how do these birds get to be the way they are. You know, they're so different from other birds. And why are they active at night? You know, they have this reputation for wisdom, but are they in fact smart? Mm. And, you know, why have we been obsessed with them for so many thousands of years? I really wanted to explore these questions and find out what we really know about owls. And it turns out we know quite a lot. You know, the science of owls is really vast and fascinating. And we've been studying them for a very long time. But it's really only lately that there have been some of the technological advances, some of the breakthroughs that are really necessary to solve some of the mysteries that have been around for centuries. And it made it a really good time to write the book.
Let's talk about, as evidenced by the sort of gruesome remains that were there in the owl box, let's talk about how good they are at getting their prey. Because you say in the book that owls are pure hunters.
They really are. They're astonishingly skilled at hunting. And it's really for three main reasons. You know, they have very keen eyesight in the darkness. They have extraordinary hearing, and they have very, very quiet flight. So we'll start with vision. You know, owls, their eyes are just enormous for their body size. So I like to tell people that if my eyes were in similar proportion to my body as an owl's eye to its body, they'd be about the size of an orange, and they'd weigh almost 4 pounds.
Wow.
So really big eyes. And they're not like ours. They're not round or even oval. They're tubular, and they're locked in their sockets in a kind of forward gaze. Mm. And that gives them binocular vision, and that's a big advantage when they're zeroing in on moving prey. And then they have these retinas that are super sensitive to light. So owls can see in very, very dim light. And for an owl, it's really all about light. So its pupils, they can swell to nearly the full size of the eye. And that lets in about twice as much light as human pupils can take in. And as a consequence, between the light collecting cells and these pupils that allow so much light in, night hunting owls actually have about 100 times the light sensitivity of a pigeon.
Wow.
It's really, really quite extraordinary.
Well, you write about that this was a kind of trade-off for owls. Owls are, as you say, the queens of adaptation. And somewhere down the line in the evolutionary process, they made this trade-off. They gave up vision, I guess, or even though their vision is quite good, but they gave up some portion of vision, I guess, in the day for better acuity in the night.
Yes, exactly. They gave up that, you know, like hawks and raptors of other kinds. They have very, very sharp vision, high acuity in daylight. And owls, you know, they're not that great in daylight, but it's in darkness that they have this incredible sensitivity. So they're seeing much better than certainly any other kind of raptor would see.
You also mentioned, this was intriguing, you write about how this helps us understand, looking at the way an owl, its pupil responds, and it also responds to sound, which is, to me, was extraordinary. But you say that helps us understand how babies process sound. Like, it led to this new test for babies. Do you mind saying something about that?
That was fascinating to me. So it was actually a discovery that occurred by accident. So a scientist was trying to test the hearing of an owl, and he noticed that when there would be like a door slamming during the experiment, the pupils of this owl would just get enlarged very suddenly. And it turns out that our eyes as humans do the same thing. And the challenge with testing a baby's hearing is that it can't say, you know, yes, I hear that in the right ear. Mm. No, I hear that in the left ear. You know, I don't hear it altogether. But you can watch their pupils. A baby's pupils will also enlarge when it hears a sound. And the thing that about owls is that this is one of the ways that they coordinate their vision and their hearing so that they're working together really to make them these astonishing hunters.
Before we get to the mechanics of hearing, which again makes them great predators, one part you explore in the book is their kind of amazing, I guess you could call it their sensory abilities. You say in the book they have a head designed for listening. And there's this researcher named Roger Payne you write about who is trying to figure out how an owl manages to, I guess, hear or sense like a mouse below the surface of the snow, like invisible prey. And the fact that they have to sort of orient themselves acoustically. Talk about this part.
Yeah. So, you know, it was really as long ago as the 1960s that Roger Payne, who's, you know, he's better known for his work on whales and whale sounds, but he was actually the first to show that an owl can catch a mouse in the pitch black and really relying only on sound. Mm. So, you know, owls that hunt by ear, like barn owls and great gray owls, they have heads that are literally designed for listening. You know, they have a flat facial disc. Mm. That acts like a kind of a big external ear, and it's almost like a feathered satellite dish, and it collects sounds and channels it toward the owl's ears. Now, I should say here that the ears of an owl, they're not those little plumicorns, right. Those little tufts that you see on the top of its head. Those are actually for camouflage. An owl's actual ears are just holes in the side of its head. And so this facial disc channels sound toward those holes. And it's really what's inside those holes that's just extraordinary and gives the owl the ability to hear the way that it does. It's the inner ear of the owl. And it's been described as the kind of the race car, or the Ferrari of sound sensitivity. Owls, they have this really big cochlea. Mm. And those are the hearing organs in the brain. So in an owl like the barn owl that Roger Payne worked with, the cochlea is just super long. I mean, it's like 3 or 4 times as long as a cochlea of most other birds. And that gives barn owls a sense of hearing that's almost unequaled in the animal world.
This hadn't occurred to me, but they have these very distinct facial expressions. Describe how this works and why this works for an owl.
Yeah, so it's one of those things that we've learned really by observing owls up close. And some of this kind of observation and research has been done by people who work one-on-one with owls in rehabilitation clinics, wildlife centers, with injured owls, or with owls that they're training to become ambassador birds, you know, birds that go into schools and teach people about what it's like to be an owl. But these people have noticed, especially the people that train these ambassador owls, that owls have a range of feelings and emotions, and they actually express them in their faces and in their feathers, in the way they hold their feet. So for instance, an owl that's in a lot of distress, that's fearful, it will have its eyes wide open, kind of popped out and bulging, and its pupils will be dilated. Its feathers will be all slicked back, and, you know, its facial disc will be pulled very taut. And its feet will get kind of what they call grippy. So it's almost standing on its talons. And if it has plumicorns, those will be raised. It's all kind of this vertical cringe. Now, you compare that with an owl that's comfortable, relaxed. Its eyes will be maybe only partly opened. Its pupils will be small. Its facial disc will be like completely relaxed. Its feathers all fluffed. You know, its feet will be sometimes tucked under it. So it's a very different looking bird. Sometimes you look at, for instance, a long-eared owl that's stressed and one that's relaxed. They look almost like different species.
is it different from a bird? Do you know what I mean? Like, there's almost some sense that this is a different kind of species itself. Or is that – I know that's not technically right, but you do wonder, don't you?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And you know, I think the people that work with other kinds of birds, other kinds of raptors, with hawks and, you know, merlins and birds like that, they will tell you that they're – you know, those birds are expressing emotion and also individuality, personality.
Yeah.
You know, that this is the thing that it's sort of hard for us to appreciate, but different birds within a species, they have different personalities, different ways of being. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one long-eared owl might be really laid back. Another might be really high strung and ornery.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, we're learning these things, the mysteries of the, of birds, particularly in owls, individuality and personality by working with closely with them, you know, one-on-one.
One of the things that you write about, sort of coming back to that auditory system that I didn't want to move on before we talked about, was how it is they identify the exact location of sound. Because it, in some ways, the way you describe it in the book is an owl kind of creates this auditory map from images. Like there's this calculation going on to do this. Do you think you understand it at this point?
I'm sure, certainly trying.
Yes.
It's not easy, and it's very counterintuitive too.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Some species of owls, they have asymmetrically placed ears, so one's higher than the other. And that actually gives them this remarkable ability to precisely locate the source of a sound in even very faint sound in three-dimensional space. So what happens, as I understand it, is this. The owl's brain compares the sounds that are arriving at each ear, how loud they are, and also which ear detects them first. And the difference in the time that it takes for those sound waves to arrive at the two different ears helps the owl gauge the exact horizontal location of sound. And the difference in loudness helps it figure out the sound's location. So, you know, an owl does all of this sound processing, you know, figuring out horizontal and vertical location within, you know, microseconds. And this is something that just blew me away. The sound localization system in an owl's brain, that's its auditory neurons that are picking up these sounds, they actually do advanced math when they're transmitting their signals. So they're adding and multiplying these incoming signals and updating them, you know, as more information about the sounds becomes available. And all of this is happening, you know, instantaneously and helps the owl pinpoint its prey in real time.
There is there's a good chance that most of the people listening right now will have seen this video, whether on TikTok or Instagram, of these BBC audiologists comparing the flight the sounds of different birds. I think it was a pigeon, one was a hawk, and of course one was an owl.
Right.
You mentioned this in the book, and you say it may not be – they may have been overdoing the fact that the owl was completely, completely silent. But when you see that video, as most people have, it's pretty extraordinary, and that is one of the things that's amazing about owls is that quiet flight. Talk a little bit about this, because this is one of the things that's amazing and kind of creepy about owls is they're so quiet.
It's true. You know, they come and go without any sound. And, you know, they sort of break the laws of physics in that way. Things are not supposed to just appear and disappear without any noise.
Yeah.
But so I agree. I mean, I think the owl's quiet flight, it's really one of the great wonders of the bird world. And, you know, if you think about it, you know, a hunting owl has to be very, very quiet in order to avoid alerting its prey, and also so that it can hear the soft sounds that prey makes. most birds, they make a lot of noise when they fly, but not owls, you know, so that little mouse or vole that's scuttling along the ground, it never hears what's coming. Mm. And it's really a combination of features. We're just beginning to tease apart the secrets of an owl's quiet flight. And part of it is that they have what's called low wing loading. Right. And that means that their wings are really big in relation to their bodies. So their flight is kind of slow and buoyant. But they also have wings and feathers that really are ingeniously shaped and squelch sound in a very particular way. You know, most birds make a lot of noise when they fly, and it's for two main reasons. The air flowing over the wing surface, that produces turbulence, and yeah. air eddies make noise, you know. Second, their feathers make a lot of noise when they rub together. So they rustle and rasp and they whoosh against each other. Owl wings don't do that. So they have these features that hush their flight. And one of them is a kind of a comb. Mm. It's a row of fine hair-like bristles on the front edge of the wing where it meets the oncoming air. And when the air hits that comb, the little serrations that are there break up the turbulence. So that effectively suppresses any kind of swooshing sound that the owl would make in flight. And then there's a soft layer of velvet made of these plush fibers that coats the feathers in the whole wing. And that silences any kind of rubbing together noise that feathers might make. And, you know, it's this combination of things, the wings and the feathers, they're so brilliant at quieting sound that, you know, designers have actually used them to model noise reducing structures in things like wind turbine blades, airplanes, even Japan's bullet trains.
So let's discuss how owls communicate. And I wanted to start with Alice. You introduced us to this great horned owl named Alice. She was injured, and I guess this is kind of rare. She imprinted on humans. And so she had all of the, as you say in the book, all of the owlish instincts, including that you know, drive to communicate. But she applied that, you say, that to humans. And so Alice offered this really interesting opportunity to learn how owls, basically talk, I guess. So talk a little bit about what, and this gets us to another great researcher, Carla Blome, head of the International Owl Center. This is in Minnesota. And she has this relationship with Alice. Talk a little bit about this. Carla's trying to figure out what Alice is trying to communicate. And because Alice is not liking it when she doesn't seem to be getting it, I guess.
No, that's exactly right. And Carla describes Alice as really, you know, very ornery, very snarky. She's petulant, and if she doesn't get what she wants, she makes a fuss. But when Carla told me that when Alice first arrived at the center, Alice would hoot at Carla, and Carla would try to hoot back to her. But Alice would get really upset because Carla wasn't hooting properly. Right. And she would actually walk over to the edge of her perch and she would smack Carla on the head. And Carla would say, "I'm sorry, I don't know what I'm supposed to do here." So it was really what launched Carla into this study to find out what's entailed in proper hooting, and also what hoots and other owl vocalizations actually mean. And it really took hundreds of hours of listening and very meticulous observation, both of Alice and also a lot of great horned owls in the wild. But Carla eventually described 15 separate vocalizations. She had Alice could do 6 kinds of hoots, 4 types of chitters, and 5 varieties of squawks. And this is the thing about this. All of those vocalizations are used in really specific contexts for very specific purposes.
It's not a language. I guess that wouldn't be proper necessarily to say that, but it's more complicated than you would think. As you say in the book, a hoot is not just a hoot.
No, that's right. The different calls, they actually communicate highly specific information about the sex of the bird who's hooting or chittering or squawking, the size, the weight, their individual identity, even their state of mind. And it's the individual identity part that I found really interesting. So, you know, the hoot of an owl is one of the few bird calls that most people know. And an owl's territorial hoots are the owl vocalizations that we most often hear. And owls are really super territorial, and the way they protect their turf is through hooting. But it turns out that that adult owls actually have very distinctive voices, and they recognize one another by voice alone to identify, you know, kin, to communicate with mates and allies, and also rivals. So these individual voices are so distinct from one another that Carla and other researchers can actually fingerprint individuals by their voice.
Wow.
And that, you know, that means that they can actually monitor populations more closely, and that's a really important tool for conservation. It also means that they can actually kind of listen in on the social lives of owls, you know, who's mating with whom, and whether couples are in fact staying together, and you know, gives them a real window on the intimate lives of owls.
And this was great. It turns out owlets begin to vocalize in the egg before they hatch.
Yeah, that stunned even Carla. She said, it's quite amazing that 2 days ahead of hatching, the chicks actually break into the air cell in their egg and they begin breathing air. And that's when they start to vocalize. And Carla said, you can actually hear the little chitters inside the egg.
So, Jennifer Ackerman, will you indulge us if we play a few sounds of owls that you refer to in the book?
Sure.
Because you say the staff at the International Owl Center, for example, they're asked often to offer their best hoots. And so this made me think, let's play some of these owl calls. The first one, maybe we should say, if you're trying to sort of reproduce the sound of an owl, this is the simplest one. At least that's what these instructors think. Like the simplest owl call on the planet, a male long-eared owl. So that's what you think is an owl, right? I mean, that it's basic, it's pretty simple, pretty straightforward.
And they're not all so straightforward.
No. And so that will get us to, I just wanted to play that as sort of a base. Let's play the barred owl call. This is one, there's this great story you tell in the book about one of the researchers was playing a barred owl call in a neighborhood. Someone asked him whether he had lost his monkey, which gets to the fact that you've got growling and howling and squalling and snarling all sort of in the barred owl call. Here's a little snippet of that. Wait, that's probably the murdered lady in the background call, right? Is that the one?
Yeah, I mean, it's such an extraordinary range of calls. I'm so glad you played this. I just came back from a stretch of time in upstate New York, and we had barred owls in the woods around us, and they sounded just like this, and it was so eerie and wonderful to just have the dark woods animated by these incredible calls.
Let me play the Eastern Screech Owl. This is the one that sounds like a ringtone, a ringing phone. You write about this in the book. That's pretty great.
Yeah. So one of the eastern screech owls that actually lives at the International Owl Center with Carla is named JR. He works as an ambassador bird there. And JR has a call that sounds just like you played, like a ringing phone. You know, when a real phone rings at the center, he responds with his own little ringing call. Yeah. And Carla told me that the staff at the center say, it's really hard to answer that phone with a straight face when JR is there in the background, you know, ringing away.
One of the kind of most intriguing, I thought, was the call of a brown fish owl. Maybe say something about this before we play it. It's so deep. It's really hard, maybe even to hear, but certainly to reproduce, I guess.
Yeah, I think it is probably the hardest owl call to make. It's so deep and, you know, really kind of below our register. But, you know, these are really interesting birds. These are birds that live on fish. Mm. And so, you know, they don't have the kind of sense of hearing that some of the other owls do, but they have this very low call, which I think probably travels well in the environments that they live in.
Listen how deep that is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that one. That's a great one.
Yeah. One of my favorites is the bark of a barking owl, which is actually sounds like a dog in the woods.
Wow.
I first heard it when I was in the Pilliga Forest in eastern Australia, and I was with a sound recording specialist. You know, we're out in the middle of nowhere, and I hear this bark, and I said, who has got their dog out here, you know?
Yeah.
And he said, that's no dog. That's a barking owl.
Wow. I did like the various characters that you mentioned, the researchers, all of them obsessed and passionate about owls. One of them that was Marjan Salvelsberg. Pronounce that for me because I'm sure I believe that.
It's Marion.
Marion okay.
Salvelsberg,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, she's extraordinary in every way. You know, she got interested in owls and owl calls. She was a musician by training, and she had suffered an illness that prevented her from continuing with her wind instrument. And so she kind of turned around to look at what else she might do. And she found owls and owl vocalizations. Mm. And she has really dedicated her life now. She has to use a mobile scooter to get around, but she lives in the Netherlands, and she is now considered the world's expert on the vocalizations of Eurasian eagle owls, which live in this quarry near where she lives. And she uses her extraordinary musical ear to tell the individual voices of these owls and who's pairing with whom. And it's really quite a wonderful story.
So I loved that part. But so I guess there's something about her training as a musician that makes her good at identifying these distinctive owl voices. It's a gift, I guess.
It is a gift, you know, and Carla Bloom calls her, you know, she's just a rocket scientist of owl vocalization. She's really got a keen ear, and she knows how to read the spectrograms that they make from the calls too. She said that, you know, it's like a musical score to her. So she's picking up on all kinds of nuances and important details that are going to teach us so much about how these owls communicate.
You mentioned she helps monitor Eurasian eagle owls, and I think it's a good time to just mention this particular owl because you say for power and ferocity, the Eurasian eagle owl doesn't really have any rivals. Say something about this particular owl. It sounds amazing.
Yeah, it is an amazing owl. And, you know, the lucky New Yorkers have one now living in Central Park, Flacco, who's been escaped from the zoo there. They are phenomenal hunters. You know, I usually tell people that the sort of range of things that an owl eats, and it's everything from, you know, small insects that are eaten by the little owls all the way up to a small roe deer or a young sheep, which is what a Eurasian eagle owl can handle. Just amazing hunters and huge birds. They're really imposing. And they're not the biggest owl on the planet. That's actually the Blakiston's fish owl, which is about the size of a fire hydrant. Kind of wacky looking, too, I have to say. But Eurasian eagle owls are a close second. And as I said, just fierce, fierce hunters.
You ask the question in the book, why are we obsessed with owls? And we'll dig into this in a second here, but it's just on a really basic level. Why do you think we are obsessed with owls? Is it just that we've always found them throughout human history to be, I don't know, to look really cool or strange, or they look different. There's something about them, and maybe that explains it almost as much as anything else.
I think they look bizarre and strange. They also look a little like us.
Yeah.
You know, I have some photographs that just, I mean, of owls with their, some of them, especially the burrowing owl, which has these, you know, sort of long stilt-like legs and these round bodies. They just look like Mr. Magoo. You know, they're so humanoid in a way. And then they have this like really fierce nature. You know, they're just these incredible hunters. They come and go without making a sound. You know, they're also associated with, you know, spirits and death because you know, that you think about it, you know, like a barn owl, this ghostly white creature, you know, which probably is frequenting vacant buildings and cemeteries. And you can understand why there's this association of these birds with this spirit life. So I think I really do think it's a blend of things. And it's fascinating to me, and that these birds have lodged so firmly in our imaginations.
You say in the book that because we've, you know, evolved in their presence, this is how you put it. You say we know their shape, like we know the shape of a snake, that, you know, they're in our myths, they're in our dreams. And this gets us back to a researcher you mentioned before, David Johnson, who was on this mission to catalog and understand, you know, the range of these human attitudes that we have about owls. And I wanted to ask you about this. And he found, you know, thousands of stories and tales. Talk a little bit about the study that – so his team did this study, you know, thousands of interviews in 26 countries, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions that they asked was, what do you believe about owls? And so you say they sort of – the answers were all over the map. But what did they understand? What did they come to realize about the way people answered that question?
Well, I think what they came to realize is that the attitudes vary tremendously across the globe. You know, of the 26 countries they surveyed, I think it was a dozen or so had a really positive view of owls.
Yeah.
There were a group of maybe 8 or 9 that were neutral, and the same number had a really negative view.
Yeah.
So the attitudes are all over the place. And, you know, I think of some cultures like, the Ainu people of northern Japan, you know, they really revere owls, the Blakiston's fish owl, and they consider them protectors of their village. It's also true of the Yagan people of Tierra del Fuego. They think of the barn owl as the wise grandmother, and she generates this life-giving water. And then you have cultures that, you know, that view owls like witches or emblems of evil, you know, they're these bad omens that are linked with death. And in Belize, owls, for instance, are viewed as real bearers of bad luck. So if an owl comes to your house and calls, it suggests to people that someone's going to get sick or die. And that's actually a view of owls, or some variation of that. It's very prevalent in many countries.
Why they're such powerful symbols is something you really kind of work through in the book. And you mentioned, for example, your 96-year-old aunt who was near the end of her life. She said to her kids, "When I go, kids, I'll send you a sign." And that night that she died, there was an owl hooting nearby. Say something about that, but also the fact that it seems like a lot of people have stories like that.
Yeah, you know, I have been on the road now with this book for some months, and the stories that people tell me about, especially about recently losing someone and feeling like witnessing an owl or hearing it, was a kind of visitation. And I think it really goes back to this idea of these birds as kind of spirit animals of some kind. And, you know, they're so rarely seen. In the case with my cousins, when my aunt died, they'd never heard or seen an owl anywhere near their house. And all of a sudden, their mom dies, and there's this bird. You know, and I've had my own experiences. And, you know, I completely understand the kind of investment in these birds of something more than just, you know, birdness, or that they do seem otherworldly and, you know, really marvelous for that reason. They're just such extraordinary birds biologically and in terms of their impact on our imagination. Really, they're very special.
There's this other part, though, that I think is interesting beyond it being like an omen or a sign or some, you know, spiritual symbol. You mentioned, for example, how native people from North America believed an owl, hearing an owl calling was the signal that, oh, it's, you know, it's time to start gathering wood, like hearing a particular one. And so a lot of these seem, you know, not just quaint or symbolic, but actually, as you say in the book, providing important information about the environment. To hear
absolutely. It's really true. And, you know, it's people that are very tuned into their environments, that are reading and listening and associating the, you know, the sounds of owls with some kind of change in the season or presence, perhaps, of prey. And so there's a really solid anthology of natural history around these birds, you know, and people have been using them as signs in this way for a very long time.
Okay, let's get to the big question. Are owls wise? I guess one thing we don't really know is just exactly how smart they're not smart like a crow. There's a different kind of how are you understanding all of this?
Well, first of all, I want to say that all birds are far more intelligent than we ever thought they were. Yeah. You know, their brains are organized in a different way from ours, but bird brains, they have a really high density of neurons. And that's what matters in the intelligent brain. So the brains of birds are extremely dense with neurons. They're very efficient. And the other thing I'll say is that as an introduction is just that the science of understanding the minds of other animals is really still in its infancy. Yeah. We tend to view intelligence really through our own lens. But there is a growing awareness, I think, that there are different kinds of intelligence and different ways of knowing in the animal world that are really sometimes hard for us even to imagine and certainly to measure. So, you know, on the question of owl smarts, you know, the science has really been swinging back and forth a lot. We used to think that owls, you know, they acted only by instinct. Their behavior was just hardwired. But now we understand that they are, in fact, intelligent. It's just in ways that we can't fully appreciate, and we sometimes have trouble measuring.
Yeah.
So, you know, as you said, they're not smart the way that parrots and corvids are smart. And, you know, those are some of the same ways that we're smart. They're very good at, you know, technical problem solving. But the people who train raptors, you know, they used to think owls weren't as bright as other birds, especially other raptors. Now they're beginning to understand the kind of subtleties and complexity of owl behavior and knowledge, and they're really changing their tune. They realized that it's actually they who are not very good at reading owls and owl behavior. It's not that the owls aren't smart. They actually are, and they're very flexible in their behavior. Mm-hmm. They're nuanced, and they really, this is the big one, they learn throughout their lives. You know, their behavior is not all hardwired. They get better at things. It's a very interesting question, and we're far, far from having any kind of definitive answer.
Well, you mentioned how this helped me understand it. You say birds embody intelligence in their skin, in their eyes, in their mm-hmm. coloring, and their flight. And that idea of them being flexible, you mentioned, or what biologists call plasticity, that was a real revelation for me anyway about owls, that they are really good at adapting. And yes. you mentioned the study of burrowing owls, how they're sort of figuring out if their habitat gets ditched, they'll find a culvert or a PVC pipe or something. And you say that in that sense, there's some kind of cause for optimism in the face of all the change that's going on in the world through owls.
Yeah, that is true. That, you know, some owls are adapting to the loss of habitat and because of development, agriculture, climate change, everything. It's really hard on a lot of owls, but some of them are adapting in really ingenious ways. And you mentioned the burrowing owls. The ones in South America, there was a fascinating study. These birds started colonizing cities, you know, just a few decades ago when they started to lose their agricultural habitat. And they, you know, they moved into cities. The scientists studying these birds have learned that they've already evolved variants in something like 100 brain genes that are important in adapting to city environments. So those are like genes that influence levels of attention, so they can focus on prey sounds rather than ambient noise, for instance, or what's called behavioral flexibility, you know, that capacity to respond in new ways to new challenges. So that really does point to something hopeful, I think, that, you know, owl populations have within them this kind of adaptability, a resourcefulness, that it's going to allow at least some individuals to respond flexibly to environmental change.
You write in an afterword in the book about what it would take to protect owls and save owls. Do you feel hopeful about that?
Oh, I have to hold two truths, which is that the changes that are occurring on our planet are devastating, and some species are really suffering. You know, the ones that are hardest hit are the ones that are living on islands, or they're restricted to very narrow ecological niches or geographic ranges. You know, species that are dependent on old growth forests or big grasslands that, you know, serve as their hunting grounds. Those kinds of habitats are just disappearing. But I also believe that there is this kind of adaptability. There's variability in a population. Some individuals are different from others, and they're bolder and more aggressive about seeking solutions to problems that are presented in the environment. Also, I think there's just tremendous research going on now, and I'm very hopeful that some of the new understanding that we have about owls is going to really help us figure out very smart ways to conserve them.
Let me ask you finally, you say in the book that by provoking these powerful reactions, which they do and have throughout human history, that owls can offer us a cultural service. What do you mean by that? Say something about that finally.
Yeah. So I think for all the reasons that we've been talking about, owls do play a cultural role. They play a role in our stories and our myths and our symbols and our artwork. That's a cultural service. And it varies, obviously, from culture to culture, but it's a really important kind of offering. You know, we tend to value the economic benefits that some species bring, and owls certainly have economic benefits. They're great at controlling rodents, and that saves farmers money. But there's also this cultural piece, and I think it's very, very important, especially to some in some parts of the world.
Jennifer Ackerman, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure to speak with you.
That's the science writer Jennifer Ackerman. Her new book is What an Owl Knows, The New Science of the World's Most Enigmatic Birds. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. If you have a comment about the show or maybe an idea, reach out. Our email is radiowest@kuer.org. Our producers are Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.